Turn to Exodus 20. They had the homeschool graduation yesterday for St. Charles County. I think there's about 48, thank you. And I've been pretty much every year since 1996, I think, when there was just like 7 or 8. So it's really grown over the years. But what I thought was cool was that three of the people that graduated yesterday, Annie Graham, John Hancock, and Sarah Wilson, were all up here on the stage today serving the Lord in various fashions. Yeah. So it's cool to see our high schoolers, and really now as they move into the next stage of their life, already serving the Lord. I was reading, we have this Bible story book that I read with my boys in Trinity. My boys are 7, 5, and Trinity's 2.5. And so we were reading the story of Hannah the other day. And it talked about Hannah and her husband, Elkanah, and then, you know, Elkanah has two wives. So we're reading this story, and I finished the first part of the story. I kind of want to, you know, use that as a little teaching moment for my boys to realize, you know, two wives, one man, you know, bad thing. So I finished that part where it talks about him having the two wives, and I say to them, is anything wrong with this story? And Logan, my 7-year-old, says, he had two wives. Like, you know, the light bulb's going off, and he's kind of contemplating that for a second. He says, that's a lot of food. Contemplates it a little longer and said, at least 3 boxes of macaroni. So, he's a pragmatist. Interesting stories when you start reading with your kids and the things that you learn. Exodus 20. We'll start in verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. I want to make a couple notes. First, in verse 2, when it says, I am the Lord your God, that word for Lord in Hebrew is Yahweh. So the Hebrew name for God, really the personal name for God that you see in the Old Testament, is Yahweh. And most Bibles, actually I think every Bible, in their translation, if you look there, it's usually all capitals. So all of them are capitalized, with the L being just a little bit bigger, but it's in all caps. They do that to signify whenever you see that all caps word in the Old Testament, it means the Hebrew word that they're translating is Yahweh. So it's, I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And then he begins with the Ten Commandments. Literally, in the Hebrew, the ten words. The ten words that he gives them. You shall have no other gods before me. And when you see, when you look throughout the Old Testament, you see this concept of no gods, no idols, repeated as a constant theme pretty much in every single book of the Old Testament. Over and over again, the point is driven home, no other gods, no idols. And when you think about it, this first commandment here of no other gods for the Ten Commandments, it's really the overarching commandment for the following 9. If you don't get that first one right, no other gods, then the other 9 really don't matter that much. I mean, if you disobey this commandment, nothing else lines up. So if this is the case, then, I mean, we need to pay careful attention to this first commandment. I mean, if this is kind of the overarching commandment that sets the tone for our relationship with God and who he is, we need to make sure we accurately understand what that commandment means. And when you look at the Ten Commandments, really the first 4, They deal specifically with our relationship with God, our vertical relationship as opposed to our horizontal relationship with one another. So you get no other gods, no idols, don't profane God's name, honor his day. All of those dealing directly with our relationship with God. And so what we need to do when we see that first commandment there of no other gods, we want to ask ourselves, well, what exactly does that mean? I mean, seriously, I think we have a pretty good concept of what it means, but it bears asking the question. Well, here's some of the options that it could mean. You can have other gods, just don't prefer them over Yahweh. You know, you can have other gods, but don't prefer them. You know, you kind of get this picture of you know, a line of gods and, you know, well, there's Yahweh and there's Baal and there's Chemosh and on and on. So you can have other gods, but just give a little preference to him. Equal gods, essentially, but choose Yahweh at least a little bit more than the others. That's one option. Second option, God is the God of the Israelites. You know, the other gods are on the same level as Yahweh, but, you know, the Philistines have their God, the Israelites have their God, the Canaanites have their God, and so on and so on and so on. So if you're an Israelite, then your option is to choose Yahweh. So there's other gods out there, and that God's powerful over there, and he's over there being powerful, and this God's over there, and that one's over there. But when it comes to Israel, then that's where Yahweh is most powerful, and that's who they need to choose, at least on a somewhat regular basis. Third option is a pyramid view. So you get this idea of, you know, there's this pyramid, you know, and there's different, each of the gods are fighting to get to that top of the pyramid, and Yahweh's at the top. And so you at least need to acknowledge that he's at the top, even though maybe in your pyramid there's different gods there. And then there's the fourth option of what it really means, that God is the only true God. He's the only true God. If you keep reading in Exodus 20, if you're still there in verse 4, this is the concept that comes out clearly. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. And repeatedly throughout the Old Testament, you see this again and again, that God leaves no doubt that he is the one true God. All other gods, all other idols are false gods or false idols. Look at Isaiah 43. In Isaiah 43, verse 10, it says, "You are my witnesses, declares the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me, no God was formed, nor shall there be any after me." I mean, he leaves no doubt. There wasn't anything before him. There's nothing after him. He and he alone. Turn one chapter over to Isaiah 44. Starting in verse 6. It says, "Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first, and I am the last. Besides me, there is no God. Who is like me? Let him proclaim it. Let him declare and set it before me, since I appointed an ancient people. Let them declare what is to come and what will happen." I mean, he's really throwing down a challenge here. If someone wants to make a claim to being a God, let's see him do what I'm asking him to do. Let's see him declare what's going to come. Let's see him declare what's going to happen. Can any God do that? The answer is no. Verse 8, "Fear not, nor be afraid. Have I not told you from of old and declared it? And you are my witnesses. Is there a God besides me? There is no rock. I know not any. Now, this was astonishingly different than the rest of the nations in the time of Israel, because the surrounding nations of Israel, they served a variety of gods. Usually, while they believed in many gods, each nation usually had their own particular god. The Philistines, as we'll read in a little bit, had their god Dagon. The Egyptians, they had a panoply of gods. Their key god was Ra. So even though they had maybe a particular god that they gave more homage to, kind of one of those first options I was talking about in terms of serving the Lord and no other gods, they still accepted that there were other gods. They just happened to choose one of those many and kind of give him a little preference. That's called henotheism, one among the many gods that they would choose. And they felt that their god was powerful in the particular region that he had his reign. So in the Philistine land, Dagon reigned. You know, if they tried to go into Israel, they were kind of putting themselves on shaky ground because they were getting outside of his territory. Now, if they could end up somehow conquering that, then that would become part of the Philistine land, and Dagon would get more control in that area. That's why when you read the story of Pharaoh, I mean, he's continually perplexed with the plagues that Moses is doing. He cannot believe why this Hebrew God in Egypt has so much power. And why, time and time again, he keeps thinking, okay, this has to be the end, this has to be the end, this has to be the end. Because he figures that at some point his God is going to be able to exert his reign. But he doesn't. The same thing happens with the Philistines. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 4. During the time of Samuel, the Philistines go to war with the Israelites. And they have this battle. The Israelites get routed. So they decide to try to rally the Israelite troops. 1 Samuel 4, verse 3. And when the troops came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is throned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. All right, so they're defeated, they're downcast, they're discouraged. Hey, let's bring the Ark. That'll rally the troops. That'll get people pumped up. Verse 5, as soon as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout, so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "A god has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. And they fled every man to his home, and there was a very great slaughter for their fellow of Israel, 30,000 foot soldiers. And the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Again, the Philistines, they saw God as being restricted to a particular region or area. And they knew that the Ark, that was the sign of God's presence, where he abode, so to speak. So they see this Ark coming in. They see, you know, basically him coming into the camp. And they're freaking out. But they defeat the Israelites. So then, what does that mean? They think they've defeated the Yahweh God, the God of the Israelites. And they're all triumphing over that. They bring the Ark into their land. But God doesn't leave any doubt in their mind that he has not been defeated. Look one chapter over at 1 Samuel 5. It says, when the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. When the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon, and when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face down on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But then when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both the hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. It goes on, the hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon, our God. Yahweh, the one true God, put their God to shame. All right, they're worshiping this golden statue, stone statue, bronze statue. They come in. First day, it's knocked over. They come in again. Hands cut off, head cut off, lying over the threshold. God was not going to have his name profaned, even among the Philistines. He was not going to allow them to think that he was defeated. Maybe his people had been defeated, but he had not been defeated. So these gods, or these idols, as we can call them, can prove snares to all of us. But God had told Israel early on that he was the Lord of all. Look briefly at Exodus 19. In verse 5, it says, now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. All the earth. Not just the promised land, but all the earth. And how could you think any different from reading Genesis 1, right? The very first verse. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God. I mean, he is the master and the Lord. So let's look at these idols. I mean, for us today, it's not a wooden or silver or gold statue, something we bow down to. I mean, that'd be too easy, right? We could easily recognize that and identify that and put that out of our lives. But some religions actually still do believe in gods, and they still worship idols, and whether they're made out of stone, bronze, silver, or gold. Hinduism. Many branches of Hinduism. There's over 6 million gods in the Hindu religion. Pick the right one, by the way. Buddhism. They believe in many gods. They call them devas. They don't really worship these devas, but they have this concept of gods. You can kind of work your way up to being one. Shintoism, major religion in Japan. It has elements of Buddhism combined with this polytheistic view of multiple gods. But, you know, many so-called gods that even our children probably read about in stories, most of those gods have disappeared. Disappeared in the sense that no one gives their allegiance to them anymore. You know, Zeus with the Greeks, Jupiter with the Romans, and their whole panoply of gods underneath them. There's really not anyone today that goes around worshiping those gods. Right? Same with the German gods, Woden and Thor. Not too many people go around. I mean, those are pretty much something that happened 2,000 years ago, and the vast majority of people realize the foolishness of that. Today, the people that we interact with on a regular basis either believe in one God, you know, maybe they're deists, maybe they're Christians. They believe in one God, or they believe in no God. Or they aren't sure if there's one God. So atheist, agnostic, or deist. That's really the three options that most of us encounter on a regular basis. Here's what one gentleman said regarding this. How can we fit these two things together? On the one hand, gods that do not exist, yet on the other hand, gods against whom we must be on guard? The answer is not too difficult. People worship powerful forces within creation as if these were deities. They are not gods, but only so-called gods, 1 Corinthians 8. Still, they are very real powers able to enslave a person totally. So for our purposes, when we're looking at idols and gods and we're trying to identify them in our own lives today, it's anything that detracts from the worship of God, anything that detracts from our relationship with God or takes the place of our worship of God or our relationship with him. Let me say that again. Anything that detracts from the worship of God or our relationship with him. Anything. Anything. It is anything that competes with the role that God should play in your life and the position that he should have in your life. It's interesting. 1 John, which is probably a book that many people recommend to someone who has just gotten saved. You know, John or 1 John. It goes over some basic things. So you're reading 1 John. You come to the very last verse in chapter 5, the very last verse of the book. And he says, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Keep yourselves from idols. This simple instruction book written to believers. And the last thought he wants going through their mind is for them to keep themselves from idols. Now, in the context here, John's been giving them instruction and warning them against false teachers. He probably has the idea of idolatry, meaning don't twist who Jesus is into something else. Don't make him to be what he is not. But if we know idols are nothing, then why the warning? Why are we warned about idols? Time and time and time and time again throughout the New Testament, we're warned about idols. It's because of this. The danger is always there to turn that which is dear to us into something which is more dear to us than God. All right? It's the danger to turn something that is dear to us into something that is more dear to us than God. Anything that is dear to us has the potential to becoming an idol. Anything. I was talking with a gentleman years ago. I was witnessing with him as a friend. And I asked him, hey, you know, what's number one in your life? Out of all the things and all the people, what's number one in your life? And he said, my wife. And I'm like, well, you know, God needs to be number one in your life. Because, you know, he was claiming to be a Christian. I said, he needs to be number one. And whatever you put in place of number one, in place of God, you put that up to the number one position, then that's really an idol in your life. Because you're putting that person or that thing into a place that only God deserved to be in. He didn't like that. A few years later, he ended up getting divorced. And we met up again, and we were talking, and I remember the conversation. For whatever reason, I wasn't going to bring it up to him. But he brought it up. And he said, I guess my idol failed me. So he realized somewhere in his heart what he had done, and that he was committing idolatry. Well, the Bible discusses various idols. Strength, it mentions in Habakkuk, you know. You get people today going out to the gym every single day, so focused on the health side of things. Gold, obviously, in Job 31. Money is personified as deity in Matthew 6 by Jesus. Covetousness. Even Paul mentions our stomach in Philippians 3. So we can make idols out of almost anything. The erotic, the desire for power, reason, nature, tradition, conscience. In the end, what do idols do? They destroy who we are. Because they require allegiance. They require loyalty. A loyalty they should not get. Look at Exodus 32. Idols end up consuming us, and they end up owning us. This is the story of the golden calf. Exodus 32, starting in verse 1, it says, "When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, 'Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.' So Aaron said to them, 'Take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me.' So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, 'These are your gods of Israel who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.' When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord.'" Notice what Aaron does here. I mean, God's doing these amazing things. He brings them out of Egypt. Slays the Egyptians. And almost immediately, they turn. Jump over to verse 19 and you see the interaction between Moses and Aaron. "And as soon as he came near the camp," Moses that is, "and saw the calf and the dancing, Moses' anger burned hot and he threw the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, 'What did this people do to you that you have brought such a great sin upon them?' And Aaron said, 'Let not the anger of my Lord burn hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil. For they said to me, "Make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of this land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. So I said to them, "Let any who have gold take it off." So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." I mean, you see what's going on here. I mean, he's blame shifting. You know how those people are. I mean, you know, it was really them. They kind of made me do it. I really didn't have an option here. Then he's making excuses, you know. "Well, I did ask for the gold, and I kind of threw it into the fire, and poof, look at this calf. I mean, I know where that came from. It just came out, right out of the fire. It's amazing." But he was lying. Look back at verse 4. It says, "He received it from their hand, and he fashioned it with a graving tool." All right? He's given great care to making this thing. And he's lying to his brother. He's lying to him. Then, to make it even worse, I believe, look at this. It says in verse 5, he built an altar. So he's taking his time, he's fashioning it, he's making it, and then he builds this altar to it so they can worship this calf. This idol tripped him up big time. And idols require us to make sacrifices to them. Very dear sacrifices. And these idols are hard to let go of. And holding on to them does great damage. Think for a second of Jacob's wife, Rachel. Right? Jacob makes the decision to leave his father-in-law, Laban. They're getting ready to go. What does Rachel do? She steals the family idols. Right? So they're setting off. Laban ends up catching up to him, and he's upset. And he's like, you know, you took the idols, you left under deceit. Jacob says, hey, whoever has the idols, you know, we'll kill them. So Rachel is, you know, sitting down. Her dad is searching everybody for these idols. And what does she do to her dad? Well, first she steals these idols from him. She dishonors him. She deceives him. She lies to him. You know, I don't know where the idols are. She's sitting right on top of them. So what will a person do for their idol? Anything. Anything. And when it comes to us serving God, it's not a both and choice. It's an either or choice. Either serve God or serve idols. Either serve God or serve the other gods of this world. You can't do both. You know, Jesus pointed out in Matthew, you can't serve God and mammon, right? One ultimately wins. One ultimately gets the allegiance of you. And sadly, time and time again, the Israelites never fully put away their idols. The prophetic books, time and time again, are telling the Israelites to put away the idols. Solomon, think of him. Supposed to be this wise man, and he ends up building shrines to honor the Ammonite god, to honor the Moabite god. Supposed to be the wisest man. You ever wondered why, how someone so wise could do that? Because wisdom, left to its own accord, without God, is foolishness. And he had turned away from God. So the greatest of wise men without God stumbled in his ways, was prone to idolatry. Same with us. Without the Lord, without seeking him and choosing him, we are prone to it as well. Simply put, idols keep us from true worship. They keep us from our relationship with God. So what does this mean when it comes to worship? To truly praise him, we have to cast down all our idols. And we even sing a song about that, casting down our idols. That's what we have to do. True worship requires that we worship him and him alone. No one else, nothing else. It is not enough for him to be second or third or anything like that. Go back to Exodus 20 for a second. We see that God takes great care when he sets up the worship of him, even to the minutest details of assigning the Levites to different tasks. You know, gatekeepers, and some of them wrote the song, some led the worship. But even when it came to the altar, Exodus 20, let's just start in verse 22. And the Lord said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the people of Israel, you have seen for yourselves that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall not make gods of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourselves gods of gold. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. If you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stones. For if you wield your tool on it, you profane it. And you shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness be exposed on it." God was concerned about the true worship here. And he is so concerned about it that he doesn't even want them touching any of those stones with one of their tools, that it might possibly distract as people are going up to the altar to make their sacrifice. And like, oh, man, that is, look at that stone. Look how they did that. Or check out that beautiful altar. And isn't that cool? He wanted to focus completely on him without any distraction whatsoever. He didn't want the possible thought of anything creeping into their mind that would distract them from God, that might take away their allegiance from God. No tool whatsoever on the altar. Look at Deuteronomy 27. In verse 5, he says something similar to Exodus. He says, "And there you shall build an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall wield no iron tool on them. You shall build an altar to the Lord your God of uncut stones, and you shall offer burnt offerings on it to the Lord your God." I mean, he didn't want anything to get in the way of worshiping him. And the dangerous thing about idols is this. Many times they creep into our lives. We don't even realize it. I mean, if you would have asked the Israelites back then, I'd say in any period, if you would have asked them, "Hey, are you a follower of Yahweh?" They'd say, "Oh, yeah, I believe in him." Yeah. "Do you worship him?" "Yeah, I do that." I mean, that's what Isaiah 58 is all about. He's basically saying, you know, it's all external. Everything you're doing is external because you've given in to your selfish desires and you've really replaced me with other gods and other idols. They creep in many times without us even realizing it. And we need to consider that perhaps maybe the reason our relationship with the Lord isn't so good is because idols have crept in. Because they will hinder our relationship with the Lord. And when you look at how the Bible deals with idols, what does it tell us to do? To crush them, grind them up, throw them out. What did Moses do to the golden calf? He ground it up. He didn't say, well, you know, this is pretty valuable, you know, all that gold, so, you know, we'll just use that the next time we come across some traitors. No, he ground it up, and he made them drink it. Crushed it, ground it, got rid of it. Acts 19. Acts 19, this is Paul in Ephesus, and we get down to verse 18. It says, also many of those who were now believers came, confessing and divulging their practices. And a number of those who had practiced magic arts brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all. And they counted the value of them and found it came to 50,000 pieces of silver. So the word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily. So they get saved, and these books really are the signatures of the gods that they had served. And they're confessing their sin. They're convicted of it. All right? What do? Go sell it to the guy in the booth next to him, all their books? No. Put it on eBay? No. What do? They burn them. They burn them. Completely get rid of it. They demolish it. No trace left behind. There was no thought, oh, you know, that money, well, that could be really used to, you know, really further the work of the Lord. No, get rid of the idols, burn them, demolish them. It wasn't enough just to kind of toss them aside. He wanted them completely abolished without a trace left. You must completely abolish and leave no trace of the idols in your life. Whatsoever. Because we cannot worship God with idols in our midst. We can't do it. See, the other gods, they didn't require the loyalty. They didn't require the allegiance that Yahweh demanded. Complete, 100%, no one else, nothing else. Look at Exodus 34. This will be the last verse. God is not content to just having a part of you. He wants all of you. 100%. See, the other gods back then, they just wanted a place on the pedestal. And as long as they could get somewhere on the pedestal and get a little allegiance, they were cool with that. God's not cool with that. He wants to be the only one on the pedestal. He wants to be the only one you're bowing down to, the only one you're worshiping, the only one that has your allegiance. Exodus 34, verse 14, it says, for you shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. I mean, think about that. It says his name is jealous. Now, I don't recommend in your prayer time going, dear jealous, you know, but he's trying to get a point across here. He is the jealous God. He is jealous for you. So much so that he will not allow idols to exist in your life and be content with that and be happy with that. He wants him completely demolished. He is jealous. He's jealous for you. He's jealous for you. That's the God we serve. He's not content with partial obedience, with half-hearted obedience. He wants all of you, every single part of you. You can't serve both God and money. You can't serve both God and sex or lust or pornography. You can't do it. You can't serve God and self-gratification. You can't do it. You have to choose. You have to choose. What was the downfall of Israel? What was their downfall? God was willing to overlook many, 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 many sins in the Old Testament when it came to Israel. What was their downfall? Their idolatry. They served and went after other gods. Many other things God does not deal with as much as he deals with the idolatry. That was their downfall. That's why they were led into captivity. The northern kingdom, the southern kingdom. Their idolatry. They refused to make God the one and only God and give him the true allegiance. You must choose. It is upon you to choose. Don't let the idol or the God in your life be the downfall of you. Choose rightly. Choose the Lord. Let's pray. Father, we pray that we would cast down our idols, that we would choose you, the one true God, that whatever hinders, whatever slows us down, whatever has even a partial allegiance of our heart, God, we would cast it out, we would smash it, we would destroy it, Lord. Change our hearts, God, to be for you and for you alone. Help us, God. Pour out your mercy and grace upon us, Lord. Make us want to want you and you alone. Whatever idols, God, we have, whatever gods are in our life, Lord, may we cast them down. May we completely obliterate them, Lord. Unto you, Lord. We pray this in your name. Amen.